3. Paul. It's no good. I've been trying to sleep for the last half hour, and I can't. Writing here is a sort of drug. It's the only thing I look forward to. This afternoon, I read what I wrote, and it seemed vivid. I know it seems vivid because my imagination fills in all the bits another person wouldn't understand. I mean, it's vanity. But it seems a sort of magic, and I just can't live in this present. I would go mad if I did. John Fowles, The Collector. Chapter 32. Oh, blessed Jesus, Ian moaned, and made a convulsive movement forward. Geoffrey grasped his friend's arm. The steady beat of the drum pulsed in his head like something heard in a killing delirium. Bees droned around them, but one paused. They simply flew past and into the clearing as if drawn by a magnet, which Geoffrey, Paul picked up the typewriter and shook it. After a time, a small piece of steel fell out onto the board across the arms of the wheelchair. He picked it up and looked at it. It was the letter T. The typewriter had just thrown its T. He thought, I'm going to complain to the management. I'm going to not just ask for a new typewriter, but fucking demand one. She's got the money, I know she does. Maybe it's squirreled away in fruit jars under the barn, or maybe it's stuffed in the walls at her laughing place. But she's got the dough. And T, my God, the second most common letter in the English language. Of course, he would ask Annie for nothing, much less demand. Once there had been a man who would at least have asked. A man who had been in a great deal more pain. A man who had had nothing to hold on to. Not even this shitty book. That man would have asked. Hurt or not, that man had had the guts to at least try to stand up to Annie Wilkes. He had been that man, and he supposed he ought to be ashamed. But that man had had two big advantages over this one. That man had had 2 feet and 2 thumbs. Paul sat reflectively for a moment, reread the last line, mentally filling in the omissions, and then simply went back to work. Better that way. Better not to ask. Better not to provoke. Outside his window, bees buzzed. It was the first day of summer. Had been. Let me go, Ian snarled, and turned on Geoffrey, his right hand curling into a fist. His eyes bulged madly from his livid face, and he seemed totally unaware of who was holding him back from his darling. Geoffrey realized with cold certainty that what they had seen when Hezekiah pulled the protective screen of bushes aside had come very close to driving Ian mad. He still tottered on the brink, and the slightest push would send him over. If that happened, he would take misery with him. Ian! Let me go, I say! Ian pulled backward with furious strength, and Hezekiah moaned fearfully. No, boss. Make them bees crazy. Them sting, mistress. Ian seemed not to hear. His eyes wild and blank, he lashed out at Geoffrey, striking his old friend high on the cheekbone. Black stars rocketed through Geoffrey's head. In spite of them, he saw Hezekiah beginning to swing the potentially deadly gosha, a sand-filled bag the Borkas favored for close work, in time to hiss, No! Let me handle this! Reluctantly, Hezekiah allowed the gosha to subside to the end of its leather string like a slowing pendulum. Then Geoffrey's head was rocked back by a fresh blow. This one mashed his lips back against his teeth, and he felt the warm, salt-sweet taste of blood begin to seep into his mouth. There was a rough purring sound, as Ian's dress shirt, now sun-faded and already torn in a dozen places, began to come apart in Geoffrey's grasp. In another moment he would be free. Geoffrey realized with dazed wonder that it was the same shirt Ian had worn to the Baron and Baroness's dinner party 3 nights ago. Of course it was. There had been no opportunity to change since then, not for Ian, not for any of them. Only 3 nights ago. But the shirt looked as if Ian had been wearing it for at least 3 years. and Geoffrey felt as if at least 300 had passed since the party. Only 3 nights ago, he thought again with stupid wonder, and then Ian was raining blows into his face.
Let me go, damn you!
Ian drove his bloody fist into Geoffrey's face again and again, his friend for whom, in his right mind, he would have died.
Do you want to demonstrate your love for her by killing her? Geoffrey asked quietly.
If you want to do that, then by all means, old boy, knock me senseless. Ian's fist hesitated. Something at least approximating sense came back into his terrified, maddened gaze.
I must go to her, he murmured like a man in a dream.
I'm sorry I hit you, Geoffrey. Truly sorry, my dear old man. And I'm sure you know it. But I must...
You see her.
He looked again as if to confirm the dreadfulness of the sight, and again made as if to rush to where Misery had been tied to a post in a jungle clearing, her arms over her head. Glimmering on her wrists and fastening her to the lowest branch of the eucalyptus, which was the only tree in the clearing, was something the Burkas had apparently taken a fancy to before sending Baron Heitzig into the mouth of the idol and to his undoubtedly terrible death. The Baron's blued steel handcuffs. This time it was Hezekiah who grabbed Ian, but the bushes rustled again and Geoffrey looked into the clearing, his breath momentarily catching in his throat, as a bit of fabric may catch on a thorn. He felt like a man who must walk up a rocky hill with a load of decayed and dangerously volatile explosives in his arms.
One sting, he thought. Just one, and it's all over for her.
No, boss, mustn't,
Hezekiah was saying with a kind of terrified patience.
It like the other boss be saying, if you go out there, the bees wake up from the daydream. And if the bees wake, it don't matter for her, she be dying of one sting or dying of 1 to 1,000 stings. If the bees wake up from the daydream, we all die. But she die first, and the most horrible.
Little by little, Ian relaxed between the two men, one of them black, the other white. His head turned toward the clearing with dreadful reluctance, as if he did not wish to look, and yet could not forbear to.
Then what are we to do? What are we to do for my poor darling?
I don't know, came to Geoffrey's lips, and in his own state of terrible distress, he was barely able to bite them back. Not for the first time, it occurred to him that Ian's possession of the woman Geoffrey loved just as dearly, if secretly, allowed Ian to indulge in an odd sort of selfishness and an almost womanly hysteria that Geoffrey himself must forego. After all, to the rest of the world he was only Misery's friend. Yes, just her friend, he thought, with half-hysterical irony. And then his own eyes were drawn back to the clearing, to his friend. Misery wore not a stitch of clothing, yet Geoffrey thought that even the most prudish church thrice-a-week village Biddy could not have faulted her for indecency. The hypothetical old prude might have run screaming from the sight of Misery, but her screams would have been caused by terror and revulsion rather than outraged propriety. Misery wore not a stitch of clothing, but she was far from naked. She was dressed in bees. From the tips of her toes to the crown of her chestnut hair, she was dressed in bees. She seemed almost to be wearing some strange nun's habit. Strange because it moved and undulated across the swells of her breasts and hips, even though there was not even a ghost of a breeze. Likewise, her face seemed encased in a wimple of almost Mohammedan modesty. Only her blue eyes peered out of the mask of bees, which crawled sluggishly over her face, hiding mouth and nose and chin and brows. More bees, giant Africa browns, the most poisonous and bad-tempered bees in all the world, crawled back and forth over the barren steel bracelets before joining the living gloves on Misery's hands. As Geoffrey watched, more and more bees flew into the clearing from all points of the compass. Yet it was clear to him, even in his current distraction, that most of them were coming from the west, where the great dark stone face of the goddess loomed. The drums pulsed their steady rhythm, in its way as much a soporific as the sleepy drone of the bees. But Geoffrey knew how deceptive that sleepiness was,
He had seen what happened to the Baroness, and only thanked God that Ian had been spared that. And the sound of that sleepy hum suddenly rising to a furious buzzsaw squeal, a sound which it had first muffled and then drowned the woman's agonized, dying screams. She had been a vain and foolish creature, dangerous as well. She had almost gotten them killed when she had freed Stringfellow's bushmaster. But silly or not, foolish or not, dangerous or not, no man or woman deserved to die like that. In his mind, Geoffrey echoed Ian's question. What are we to do? What are we to do for our poor darling? Ezekiel said, Nothing can do now, boss. But she in no danger. As long as the drums they beat, the bees will sleep. And Mistress, she is going to sleep too. Now the bees covered her in a thick and moving blanket. Her eyes, open but unseeing, seemed to be receding into a living cave of crawling, stumbling, droning bees. And if the drums stop? Geoffrey asked in a low, almost strengthless voice. And just then, the drums did. For a mom, Paul looked unbelievingly at the last line, then picked the royal up. He had gone on lifting it like some weird barbell when she was out of the room, God knew why, and shook it again. The keys clittered, and then another chunk of metal fell out on the board which served as his desk. Outside, he could hear the roaring sound of Annie's bright blue riding lawnmower. She was around front, giving the grass a good trim so those cock-a-doodle Roydmans wouldn't have anything to talk about in town. He set the typewriter down, then rocked it up so he could fish out this new surprise. He looked at it in the strong late-afternoon sunlight slanting in through the window. His expression of disbelief never altered. Printed in raised and slightly ink-stained metal on the head of the key was E. Just to add to the fun, the old royal had now thrown the most frequently used letter in the English language. Paul looked at the calendar. The picture was of a flowered meadow and the month said May, but Paul kept his own dates now on a piece of scrap paper, and according to his homemade calendar, it was June 21st. Roll out those lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer, he thought sourly, and threw the key hammer in the general direction of the wastebasket. Well, what do I do now? He thought. But of course he knew what came next. Longhand. That was what came next. But not now. Although he had been tearing along like a house of fire a few seconds ago, anxious to get Ian, Geoffrey, and the ever-amusing Hezekiah caught in the Borkus ambush so that the entire party could be transported to the caves behind the face of the idol for the rousing finale, he was suddenly tired. The hole in the paper had closed with an adamant bang. Tomorrow. He would go to Longhand tomorrow. Fuck Longhand. Complain to the management, Paul. But he would do no such thing. Annie had gotten too weird. He listened to the monotonous snarl of the riding lawnmower, saw her shadow, and as so often happened when he thought of how weird Annie was getting, his mind recalled the image of the axe rising, then falling, the image of her horrid, impassive, deadly face splattered with his blood. Broken, every word he screamed, the squeal of the axe pulling away from the severed bone, the blood on the wall, all crystal clear. And as he also so often did, he tried to block this memory and found himself a second too late. Because the crucial plot twist of Fast Cars concerned Tony Bonasaro's near-fatal crack-up in his last desperate effort to escape the police, and this led to the epilogue, which consisted of the bruising interrogation conducted by the late Lieutenant Gray's partner in Tony's hospital room. Paul had interviewed a number of crash victims. He had heard the same thing time and time again. It came in different wrappers, but it always boiled down to the same thing. I remember getting into the car. And I remember waking up here. Everything else is a blank. Why couldn't that have happened to him? Because writers remember everything, Paul. Especially the hurts. Strip a writer to the buff, point to the scars, and he'll tell you the story of each small one. From the big ones, you get novels, not amnesia. A little talent is a nice thing to have if you want to be a writer. But the only real requirement is that ability to remember the story of every scar. Art consists of the persistence of memory. Who had said that? Thomas Sass? William Faulkner? Cyndi Lauper? But that last name brought its own association, a painful and unhappy one under these circumstances. A memory of Cyndi Lauper hiccuping her way cheerfully through Girls Just Want to Have Fun that was so clear it was almost auditory. Oh, Daddy dear, you're still number one. But girls, they want to have fun on. Oh, when the working day is done, girls just want to have fun. Suddenly he wanted a hit of rock and roll worse than he had ever wanted a cigarette. It didn't have to be Cyndi Lauper. Anyone would do. Jesus Christ, Ted Nugent would be just fine. The axe coming down. The whisper of the axe. Don't think about it. But that was stupid. He kept telling himself not to think about it, knowing all the while that it was there, like a bone in his throat. Was he going to let it stay there? Or was he going to be a man and sick the fucking thing up? Another memory came then. It seemed like this was an all-request oldies day for Paul Sheldon. This one was of Oliver Reed as the mad but silkily persuasive scientist in David Cronenberg's movie The Brood. Reed urging his patients at the Institute of Psychoplasmatics, a name Paul had found deliciously funny, to go through it. Go all the way through it. Well, maybe sometimes that wasn't such bad advice. I went through it once. That was enough. Bullshit was what that was. If going through things once was enough, he would have been a fucking vacuum cleaner salesman like his father. Go through it, then. Go all the way through it, Paul. Start with misery. No. Yes. Fuck you. Paul leaned back, put his hand over his eyes, and like it or not, he began to go through it. All the way through it. He hadn't died, hadn't slept, but for a while after Annie hobbled him, the pain went away. It only drifted, feeling untethered from his body, a balloon of pure thought rising away from its string. Oh, shit, why was he bothering? She had done it. And all the time between then and now had been pain and boredom and occasional bouts of work on his stupidly melodramatic book to escape the former two. The whole thing was meaningless. Oh, but it's not. There is a theme here, Paul. It's the thread that runs through everything. The thread that runs so true. Can't you see it? Misery, of course. That was the thread that ran through everything. But true thread or false, it was so goddamn silly. As a common noun, it meant pain, usually lengthy and often pointless. As a proper one, it meant a character in a plot, the latter most assuredly lengthy and pointless, but one which would nonetheless end very soon. Misery ran through the last 4, maybe it was 5, months of his life, all right. Plenty of misery. Misery day in and misery day out. But surely that was too simple. Surely, oh no, Paul, nothing is simple about misery. Except that you owe her your life, such as that may be. Because you turned out to be Scheherazade after all, didn't you? Again he tried to turn aside from these thoughts, but found himself unable. The persistence of memory and all that. Hacks just want to have fun. Then an unexpected idea came. A new one which opened a whole new avenue of thought. What you keep overlooking, because it's so obvious, is that you were, are, also Scheherazade to yourself. He blinked, lowering his hand and staring stupidly out into the summer he had never expected he would see. Annie's shadow passed and then disappeared again. Was that true? Scheherazade to myself? He thought again. If so, then he was faced with an idiocy that was utterly colossal. He owed his survival to the fact that he wanted to finish the piece of shit Annie had coerced him into writing. He should have died, but couldn't. Not until he knew how it all came out. Oh, you're fucking crazy.
You sure?
No. He was no longer sure. Not about anything. With one exception. His whole life had hinged and continued to hinge on misery. He let his mind drift. The cloud, he thought. Begin with a cloud. This time the cloud had been darker, denser, somehow smoother. There was a sensation not of floating, but of sliding. Sometimes thoughts came, and sometimes there was pain. And sometimes, dimly, he heard Annie's voice, sounding the way it had when the burning manuscript in the barbecue had threatened to get out of control.
Drink this, Paul. You've got to.
Sliding. No. That was not quite the right verb. The right verb was sinking. He remembered a telephone call which had come at 3 a.m. This was when he was in college. Sleepy fourth-floor dorm proctor hammering on his door, telling him to come on and answer the fucking phone. His mother.
Come home as quick as you can, Polly. Your father has had a bad stroke. He's sinking.
And he had come as fast as he could, pushing his old Ford wagon to 70 in spite of the front-end shimmy that developed at speeds over 50. But in the end, it had all been for nothing. When he got there, his father was no longer sinking, but sunk. How close had he himself come to sinking on the night of the axe? He didn't know, but the fact that he had felt almost no pain during the week following the amputation was a pretty clear indication of just how close, perhaps. That and the panic in her voice. He had lain in a semi-coma, barely breathing because of the respiratory depressant side effects of the medication, the glucose drip back in his arms again. And what brought him out of it was the beat of drums and the drone of bees. Burka drums. Burka bees. Burka dreams. Color bleeding slowly and relentlessly into a land and a tribe that were never beyond the margins of the paper on which he wrote. A dream of the goddess. The face of the goddess, looming black over the jungle green, brooding and eroded. Dark goddess, dark continent, a stone head full of bees. Overlying even all this was a picture, which grew clearer and clearer, as if a giant slide had been projected against the cloud in which he lay, as time passed. It was a picture of a clearing in which one old eucalyptus tree stood. Hanging from the lowest branch of this tree was an old-fashioned pair of blued steel handcuffs. Bees were crawling over them. The cuffs were empty. They were empty because misery had escaped. She had, hadn't she? Wasn't that how the story was supposed to go? It had been, but now he wasn't so sure. Was that what those empty handcuffs meant? Or had she been taken away? Taken into the idol? Taken to the queen bee? The big babe of the Burkas? You were also Scheherazade to yourself. Who are you telling the story for, Paul? Who are you telling it to? To Annie? Of course not. He did not look through that hole in the paper to see Annie, or please Annie. He looked through it to get away from Annie. The pain had started, and the itch. The cloud began to lighten again and rift apart. He began to glimpse the room, which was bad, and Annie, which was even worse. Still, he had decided to live. Some part of him that was as addicted to the chapter plays as Annie had been as a child had decided he could not die until he saw how it all came out. Had she escaped, with the help of Ian and Jeffrey? Or had she been taken into the head of the goddess? It was ridiculous, but these stupid questions actually seemed to need answering. She didn't want to let him go back to work. Not at first. He could see in her skittery eyes how frightened she had been and still was, how close he had come. She was taking extravagant care of him, changing the bandages on his weeping stump every aide who knows she will never get a medal for what she has done, although she deserves one. She had done it every 4 hours.
giving him sponge baths and alcohol rubs, as if to deny what she had done. Work, she said, would hurt him.
It would put you back, Paul. I wouldn't say it if it weren't so, believe me. At least you know what's ahead. I'm dying to find out what happens next.
It turned out she had read everything he had written. All his pre-surgery work, you might say, while he lingered near death. Better than 300 manuscript pages. He hadn't filled in the ends in the last 40 or so. Annie had done that. She showed him these with an uneasily defiant sort of pride. Her ends were textbook neat, a striking comparison with his own, which had degenerated into a humpbacked scrawl. Although Annie had never said so, he believed she had filled in the ends either as another evidence of her solicitude. How can you say I was cruel to you, Paul, when you see all the ends I have filled in? Or as an act of atonement, or possibly even a quasi-superstitious rite. Enough bandage changes, enough sponge baths, enough ends filled in, and Paul would live. Burka be woman work powerful, moja magic buona. Fill in all these hoodaddy ends and all will be well again. That was how she had begun. But then the goddess set in. Paul knew all the symptoms. When she said she was dying to find out what happened next, she wasn't kidding. Because you went on living to find out what happened next. Isn't that what you're really saying? Crazy as it was, shameful even in its absurdity, he thought it was. The gotta. It was something he had been irritated to find he could generate in the misery books almost at will, but in his mainstream fiction erratically or not at all. You didn't know exactly where to find the gotta, but you always knew when you did. It made the needle of some internal Geiger counter swing all the way over to the end of the dial. Even sitting in front of the typewriter slightly hungover, drinking cups of black coffee and crunching a Rolaid or two every couple of hours, knowing he should give up the fucking cigarettes, at least in the morning, but unable to bring himself to the sticking point. Months from finishing and light years from publication, you knew the gotta when you got it. Having it always made him feel slightly ashamed, manipulative, but it also made him feel vindicated in his labor. Christ, days went by, and the hole in the paper was small. The light was dim, the overheard conversations witless. You pushed on because that was all you could do. Confucius say, if man want to grow one row of corn, must first shovel one ton of shit. And then one day the hole widened to vista vision width, and the light shone through like a sun ray in a Cecil B. DeMille epic, and you knew you had the gotta, alive and kicking. The gotta, as in, I think I'll stay up another 15-20 minutes, honey. I gotta see how this chapter comes out. Even though the guy who says it spent the day at work thinking about getting laid, and knows the odds are good his wife is going to be asleep when he finally gets up to the bedroom. The gotta, as in, I know I should be starting supper now. He'll be mad if it's TV dinners again, but I gotta see how this ends. I gotta know, will she live? I gotta know, will he catch the shitheel who killed his father? I gotta know if she finds out her best friend's screwing her husband. The gotta. Nasty as a hand job in a sleazy bar. Fine as a fuck from the world's most talented call girl. Oh boy, it was bad. And oh boy, it was good. And oh boy, in the end, it didn't matter how rude it was or how crude it was. Because in the end, it was just like the Jackson said on that record. Don't stop till you get enough. You were also Scheherazade to yourself. That was not an idea he was able to articulate or even understand. Not then. He had been in too much pain. But he had known just the same, hadn't he? Not you. The guys in the sweatshop. They knew. Yes. That had the ring of the right. The sound of the riding mower swelled louder. Annie came into view for a moment. She looked at him, saw him looking back, and raised a hand to him. He raised one of his own, the one with the thumb still on it, in return. She passed from sight again. Good deal. He was finally able to convince her that returning to work would put him forward, not back. He was haunted by the specificity of those images which had lured him out of the cloud. And haunted was exactly the right word. Until they were written down, they were shades which would remain unlaid. And while she hadn't believed him, not then, she had allowed him to go back to work just the same. Not because he had convinced her, but because of the gata. At first he had been able to work only in painfully short bursts, 15 minutes, maybe half an hour if the story really demanded it of him. Even short bursts were agony. A shift in position caused the stump to come brightly alive, the way a smoldering brand will burst into flame when fanned by a breeze. It hurt furiously while he wrote, but that was not the worst. The worst was the hour or two afterward, when the healing stump would madden him with a drony itch, like swarming sleepy bees. He had been right, not her. He never became really well, probably could not do so in such a situation. But his health did improve and some of his strength came back. He was aware that the horizons of his interest had shrunk, but he accepted this as the price of survival. It was a genuine wonder he had survived it all. Sitting here in front of this typewriter, with its increasingly bad teeth, looking back over a period which had consisted of work rather than events, Paul nodded. Yes, he supposed he had been his own Scheherazade, just as he was his own dream woman when he grabbed hold of himself and jacked off to the feverish beat of his fantasies. He didn't need a psychiatrist to point out that writing had its own autoerotic side. You beat a typewriter instead of your meat. But both acts depended largely on quick wits, fast hands, and a heartfelt commitment to the art of the far-fetched. But hadn't there also been some sort of fuck, even of the driest variety? Because once he started again, well, she wouldn't interrupt him while he was working, but she would take each day's output as soon as he was done, ostensibly to fill in the missing letters. But actually, he knew this by now, just as sexually acute men know which dates will put out at the end of the evening and which ones will not, to get her fix, to get her gotta. The chapter plays, yes, back to that. Only for the last few months she's been going every day instead of just on Saturday afternoons. And the Paul who takes her is her pet writer instead of her older brother. His stints at the typewriter grew gradually longer as the pain slowly receded, and some of his endurance returned. But ultimately he wasn't able to write fast enough to satisfy her demands. The gotta, which had kept them both alive, and it had, for without it she surely would have murdered both him and herself long since, was also what had caused the loss of his thumb. It was horrible, but also sort of funny. Have a little irony, Paul. It's good for your blood. And think how much worse it could have been. It could have been his penis, for instance. And I only have one of those, he said, and began to laugh wildly in the empty room, in front of the hateful royal with its gap-toothed grin. He laughed until his gut and stump both ached, laughed until his mind ached. At some point the laughter turned to horrible dry sobs that awoke pain even in what remained of his left thumb. And when that happened, he was finally able to stop. He wondered in a dull sort of way how close he was to going insane. Not that it really mattered, he supposed. One day, not long before the thumbectomy, perhaps even less than a week, Annie had come in with two giant dishes of vanilla ice cream, a can of Hershey's chocolate syrup, a pressure can of Ready Whip, and a jar in which maraschino cherries red as heart's blood floated like biology specimens. "I thought I'd make a Sunday's, Paul," Annie said. Her tone was spuriously jolly. Paul didn't like it. Not her tone of voice, nor the uneasy look in her eyes. "I'm being a naughty girl," that look said. It made him wary, put his wind up. It was too easy for him to imagine her looking exactly the same way when she put a heap of clothes on one set of stairs, a dead cat on the other. "Why, thank you, Annie," he said, and watched as she poured the syrup and puffed two cumulus clouds of whipped cream out of the pressure can. She performed these chores with the practiced heavy hand of the longtime sugar junkie. "No need for thanks. You deserve it. You've been working so hard." She gave him his sundae.
The sweetness became cloying after the third bite, but he kept on. It was wiser. One of the key rules to survival here on the scenic western slope was to wit, when Annie's treatin', you best be eatin'. There was silence for a while, and then Annie put her spoon down, wiped a mixture of chocolate syrup and melting ice cream off her chin with the back of her hand, and said pleasantly, "Tell me the rest." Paul put his own spoon down. "I beg your pardon?" "Tell me the rest of the story. I can't wait. I just can't." And hadn't he known this was coming? Yes. If someone had delivered all 20 reels of the new Rocket Man chapter play to Annie's house, would she have waited, parceling out only one a week, or even one a day? He looked at the half-demolished avalanche of her sundae, one cherry almost buried in whipped cream, another floating in chocolate syrup. He remembered the way the living room had looked, with sugar-glazed dishes everywhere. No, Annie was not the waiting type. Annie would have watched all 20 episodes in one night, even if they gave her eye strain and a splitting headache. Because Annie loved sweet things. "I can't do that," he said. Her face had darkened all at once, but hadn't there been a shadowy relief there as well?
"Oh, why not?"
"Because you wouldn't respect me in the morning," he thought of saying, and clamped down on that, clamped down hard. "Because I'm a rotten storyteller," he answered instead. She slurped up the remainder of her sundae in 5 huge spoonfuls that would have left Paul's throat gray with frostbite. Then she set her dish down and looked at him angrily, not as if he were the great Paul Sheldon, but as if he were someone who had presumed to criticize the great Paul Sheldon.
"If you're such a rotten storyteller, how come you have bestsellers, and millions of people love the books you write?"
"I didn't say I was a rotten story writer. I actually happen to think I'm pretty good at that. But as a storyteller, I'm the pits."
"You're just making up a big cock-a-doodle excuse."
Her face was darkening. Her hands were clenched into shiny fists on the heavy material of her skirt. Hurricane Annie was back in the room. Everything that went around came around, except things no longer had been quite the same, had they? He was as scared of her as ever, but her hold over him had nonetheless diminished. His life no longer seemed like such a big deal, gotta or no gotta. He was only afraid she would hurt him. "It's not an excuse," he had replied. "The two things are like apples and oranges, Annie. People who tell stories usually can't write stories. If you really think people who can write stories can talk worth a damn, you never watch some poor slob of a novelist fumbling his way through an interview on the Today Show."
"Well, I don't want to wait," she sulked. "I made you that nice sundae, and the least you could do is tell me a few things. Doesn't have to be exactly the whole story, I guess. But did the Baron kill Calthorpe?"
Her eyes sparkled. "That's one thing I really want to know. And what did he do with the body if he did? Is it all cut up in that trunk his wife won't let out of her sight? That's what I think." Paul shook his head, not to indicate she had it wrong, but to indicate he would not tell. She became even blacker. Yet her voice was soft. "You're making me very angry. You know that, don't you, Paul?" "Of course I know it, but I can't help it."
"I could make you help it. I could make you tell."
But she looked frustrated, as if knowing that she could not. She could only make him say some things, but she could not make him tell. "Annie, do you remember telling me what a little kid says to his mother when she catches him playing with a cleaning fluid under the sink and makes him stop? Mommy, you're mean. Isn't that what you're saying now? Pa, you're mean.
If you make me much madder, I don't promise to be responsible," she said.
But he sensed the crisis was already past. She was strangely vulnerable to these concepts of discipline and behavior. "Well, I'll have to chance that," he said, "because I'm just like that mother. I'm not saying no to be mean or to spite you. I'm saying no because I really want you to like the story.
And if I give you what you want, you won't like it. And you won't want it anymore.
And then what will happen to me, Annie? He thought. But he did not say.
At least tell me if that nigger Hezekiah really does know where Misery's father is. At least tell me that.
Do you want the novel, or do you want me to fill out a questionnaire?
Don't you take that sarcastic tone to me. And don't you pretend you don't understand what I'm saying, he shouted back.
She recoiled from him in surprise and unease, the last of that blackness going out of her face, and all that was left was that weird little girl look, that I'd been naughty look.
You want to cut open the golden goose. That's what it comes down to. But when the farmer in the story finally did that, all he had was a dead goose and a bunch of worthless guts. All right, she said. All right, Paul. Are you going to finish your Sunday?
I can't eat any more, he said.
I see. I've upset you. I'm sorry. I expect that you're right. I was wrong to ask.
She was perfectly calm again. He had half expected another period of deep depression or rage to follow, but none had. They had simply gone back to the old routine. Paul writing, Annie reading each day's output, and enough time had passed between the argument and the thumbectomy that Paul had missed the connection. Until now. I bitched about the typewriter, he thought, looking at it now and listening to the drone of the mower. It sounded fainter now, and he was marginally aware that wasn't because Annie was moving away, but because he was. He was drowsing off. He did that a lot now, simply drowsed off like some old fart in a nursing home. Not a lot. I only bitched about it that once. But once was enough, wasn't it? More than enough. That was, what? A week after she brought those Oogie Sundays. Just about that. Just 1 week and one bitch. About how the clunk of that dead key was driving me crazy. I didn't even suggest she get another used typewriter from Nancy Whoremonger, or whoever that woman was, one with all its keys intact. I just said those clunks are driving me crazy. And then in almost no time at all, presto changeo, when it comes to Paul's left thumb, now you see it, now you don't. Except she didn't really do it because I bitched about the typewriter, did she? She did it because I told her no, and she had to accept that. It was an act of rage. The rage was the result of realization. What realization? Why, that she didn't hold all the cards after all. That I had a certain passive hold over her. The power of the gata. I turned out to be a pretty passable Scheherazade after all. It was crazy. It was funny. It was also real. Millions might scoff, but only because they failed to realize how pervasive the influence of art, even of such a degenerate sort as popular fiction, could become. Housewives arranged their schedules around afternoon soaps. If they went back into the workplace, they made buying a VCR a top priority, so they could watch those same soap operas at night. When Arthur Conan Doyle killed Sherlock Holmes at Reichenbach Falls, all of Victorian England rose as one and demanded him back. The tone of their protests had been Annie's exactly. Not bereavement, but outrage. Doyle was berated by his own mother when he wrote and told her of his intention to do away with Holmes. Her indignant reply had come by return mail. Kill that nice Mr. Holmes? Foolishness. Don't you dare. Or there was the case of his friend Gary Rudman, who worked for the Boulder Public Library. When Paul had dropped over to see him one day, he had found Gary's shades drawn and a black crepe fluff on the door. Concerned, Paul had knocked hard until Gary answered. Go away, Gary had told him. I'm feeling depressed today. Someone died. Someone important to me. When Paul asked who, Gary had responded tiredly, Vanderbalk. Paul had heard him walk away from the door, and although he knocked again, Gary had not come back. Vandervalk, it turned out, was a fictional detective created and then uncreated by a writer named Nicholas Freeling. Paul had been convinced Gary's reaction had been more than false. He thought it had been pretentiously arty. In short, a pose. He continued to feel this way until 1983, when he read The World According to Garp. He made the mistake of reading the scene where Garp's younger son dies, impaled on a gear shift lever, shortly before bed. It was hours before he slept. The scene would not leave his mind. The thought that grieving for a fictional character was absurd did more than cross his mind during his tossings and turnings. For grieving was exactly what he was doing, of course. The realization had not helped, however, and this had caused him to wonder if perhaps Gary Rudman hadn't been a lot more serious about Vandervalk than Paul had given him credit for at the time. And this had caused another memory to resurface, finishing William Golding's Lord of the Flies at the age of 12 on a hot summer day, going to the refrigerator for a cold glass of lemonade, and then suddenly changing direction and speeding up from an amble to an all-out bolt which had ended in the bathroom. There he had leaned over the toilet and vomited. Paul suddenly remembered other examples of this odd mania, the way people had mobbed the Baltimore docks each month when the packet bearing the new installment of Mr. Dickens' Little Dorrit or Oliver Twist was due. Some had drowned, but this did not discourage the others. The old woman of 105 who had declared she would live until Mr. Galsworthy finished the Forsyth saga, and who had died less than an hour after having the final page of the final volume read to her. The young mountain climber, hospitalized with a supposedly fatal case of hypothermia, whose friends had read The Lord of the Rings to him nonstop, around the clock, until he came out of his coma. Hundreds of other such incidents. Every best-selling writer of fiction would, he supposed, have his own personal example or examples of radical reader involvement, with the make-believe worlds the writer creates, examples of the Scheherazade complex, Paul thought now, half-dreaming as the sound of Annie's mower ebbed and flowed at some great echoing distance. He remembered getting two letters suggesting misery theme parks on the order of Disney World or Great Adventure. One of these letters had included a crude blueprint. But the Blue Ribbon winner, at least until Annie Wilkes had entered his life, had been Mrs. Roman D. Sandpiper III of Ink Beach, Florida. Mrs. Roman D. Sandpiper, whose given name was Virginia, had turned an upstairs room of her home into Misery's parlor. She included Polaroids of Misery's spinning wheel, Misery's escritoire, complete with half-completed bread-and-butter note to Mr. Favory, saying she would be in attendance at the school hall recitation on 20th November instant. Done in what Paul thought was an eerily apt hand for his heroine. Not a round and flowing lady's script, but a half-feminine copperplate. Misery's couch, Misery's sampler. Let love instruct you. Do not presume to instruct love, etc., etc. The furnishings, Mrs. Roman D., Virginia Sandpiper's letter said, were all genuine, not reproductions, and while Paul could not tell for sure, he guessed that it was the truth. If so, this expensive bit of make-believe must have cost Mrs. Roman D. Virginia Sandpiper thousands of dollars. Mrs. Roman D. Virginia Sandpiper hastened to assure him that she was not using his character to make money, nor did she have any plans in that direction, heaven forbid. But she did want him to see the pictures, and to tell her what she had wrong, which she was sure must be a great deal. Mrs. Roman D. Virginia Sandpiper also hoped for his opinion. Looking at these pictures had given him a feeling which was strange yet eerily intangible. It had been like looking at photographs of his own imagination, and he knew from that moment on, whenever he tried to imagine Misery's little combination parlor and study, Mrs. Roman D. Virginia Sandpiper's Polaroids would leap immediately into his mind, obscuring imagination with their cheery but one-dimensional concreteness. Tell her what was wrong? That was madness. From now on, he would be the one to wonder about that. He had written back, a brief note of congratulations and admiration, a note which hinted not at all at certain questions concerning Mrs. Roman D. Virginia Sandpiper which had crossed his mind. How tightly wrapped was she, for instance? And had received another letter in return, with a fresh slew of Polaroids. Mrs. Roman D. Virginia Sandpiper's first communication had consisted of a 2-page handwritten letter and 7 Polaroids. His second consisted of a 10-page handwritten letter and 40 Polaroids. The letter was an exhaustive and ultimately exhausting manual of where Mrs. Roman D. Virginia Sandpiper had found each piece, how much she had paid, and the restoration processes involved. Mrs. Roman D. Virginia Sandpiper told him that she had found a man named McKibben who owned an old squirrel rifle and had gotten him to put the bullet hole in the wall by the chair. While she could not swear to the historical accuracy of the gun, Mrs. Roman D. Virginia Sandpiper admitted she knew the caliber was right. The pictures were mostly close detail shots, but for the handwritten captions on the back, they could have been photos in one of those What Is This Picture features in puzzle magazines, where maxi photography makes the straight arm of a paperclip look like a pylon and the pop top of a beer can like a Picasso sculpture. Paul had not answered this letter, but that had not deterred Mrs. Roman D. Virginia Sandpiper, who had sent five more. The last letter had been simply, stiffly signed, Mrs. Roman D. Sandpiper. The invitation, however parenthetically made, to call her Virginia, had been withdrawn. This woman's feelings, obsessed though they might have been, had never evolved into Annie's paranoid fixation. But Paul understood now that the wellspring had been the same. The Scheherazade complex. The deep and elemental drawing power of the Gata. His floating deepened. He slept. He dozed off these days as old men doze off, abruptly and sometimes at inappropriate times, and he slept as old men sleep, which is to say, only separated from the waking world by the thinnest of skins. He didn't stop hearing the riding mower, but its sound became deeper, rougher, choppier, the sound of the electric knife. He had picked the wrong day to start complaining about the Royal and its missing end, and of course there never was a right day to say no to Annie Wilkes. Punishment might be deferred, but never escaped. Well, if it bothers you so much, I'll just have to give you something to take your mind off that old inn. He heard her rummaging around in the kitchen, throwing things, cursing in her strange Annie Wilkes language. 10 minutes later, she came in with a syringe, the betadine, and the electric knife. Paul began to scream at once. He was, in a way, like Pavlov's dogs. When Pavlov rang a bell, the dogs salivated. When Annie came into the guest bedroom with a hypo, a bottle of betadine and a sharp cutting object, Paul began to scream. She had plugged the knife into the outlet by his wheelchair, and there had been more pleading and more screaming and more promises that he would be good. When he tried to thrash away from the hypo, she told him to sit still and be good, or what was going to happen would happen without the benefit of even light anesthesia. When he continued to pull away from the needle, mewling and pleading, Annie suggested that if that was really the way he felt, maybe she just ought to use the knife on his throat and be done with it. Then he had been still, and let her give him the injection. And this time the betadine had gone over his left thumb as well as the blade of the knife. When she turned it on and the blade began to saw rapidly back and forth in the air, the betadine flew in a spray of maroon droplets she seemed not to notice. And in the end, of course, there had been much redder droplets spraying into the air as well. Because when Annie decided on a course of action, she carried it through. Annie was not swayed by pleas. Annie was not swayed by screams. Annie had the courage of her convictions. As the humming, vibrating blade sank into the soft web of flesh between the soon-to-be-defunct thumb and his first finger, she assured him again in her "This Hurts Mother More Than It Hurts Polly" voice that she loved him. Then, that night, "You're not dreaming, Paul. You're thinking about things you don't dare think about when you're awake. So wake up. For God's sake, wake up." He couldn't wake up. She had cut his thumb off in the morning, and that night she had swept gaily into the room where he sat in a stupid daze of drugs and pain, with his wrapped left hand held against his chest, and she had a cake, and she was bellowing "Happy birthday to you" in her on-key but tuneless voice, although it was not his birthday. And there were candles all over the cake, and sitting in the exact center, pushed into the frosting like an extra big candle, had been his thumb. His gray, dead thumb, the nail slightly ragged because he sometimes chewed it when he was stuck for a word. And she told him, "If you promise to be good, Paul, you can have a piece of birthday cake. You won't have to eat any of the special candle." So he promised to be good,
because he didn't want to be forced to eat any of the special candle, but also because mostly because surely, because Annie was great, Annie was good, let us thank her for our food, including that we don't have to eat. Girls just want to have fun, but something wicked this way comes. Please don't make me eat my thumb. Annie the mom, Annie the goddess. When Annie's around, you better stay honest. She knows when you've been sleeping. She knows when you're awake. She knows if you've been bad or good, so be good for goodness sake. You better not cry, you better not pout. But most of all, you better not scream. Don't scream. Don't scream. Don't scream. Don't. He hadn't. And now as he awoke, he did so with a jerk that hurt him all over, hardly aware that his lips were pressed tightly together to keep the scream inside, although the thumbectomy had happened over a month ago. He was so preoccupied with not screaming that for a moment he didn't even see what was coming into the driveway. And when he did see it, he believed at first that it must be a mirage. It was a Colorado State Police car. Following the amputation of his thumb, there had been a dim period when Paul's greatest single accomplishment, other than working on the novel, had been to keep track of the days. He had become pathological about it, sometimes spending as long as 5 minutes lost in a daze, counting back, making sure he hadn't somehow forgotten one. "I'm getting as bad as she is," he thought once. His mind had returned wearily. So what? He had done pretty well with a book following the loss of his foot, during what Annie so mincingly called his convalescent period. No, pretty well was false modesty if ever there was such a thing. He had done amazingly well for a man who had once found it impossible to write if he was out of cigarettes, or if he had a backache or a headache a degree or two above a low drone. It would be nice to believe he had performed heroically, but he supposed it was only that escape thing again, because the pain had been really dreadful. When the healing process finally did begin, he thought the phantom itch of the foot which was no longer there was even worse than the pain. It was the arch of the missing foot which bothered him the most. He awoke time after time in the middle of the night, using the big toe of his right foot to scratch thin air, 4 inches below the place where, on that side, his body now ended. But he had gone on working just the same. It wasn't until after the thumbectomy and that bizarre birthday cake like a leftover prop from whatever happened to baby Jane, that the balls of crumpled-up paper had begun to proliferate in the wastebasket again. Lose a foot, almost die, go on working. Lose a thumb and run into some kind of weird trouble. Wasn't it supposed to be the other way around? Well, there was the fever. He had spent a week in bed with that. But it was pretty minor league stuff. The highest his temperature had ever gone was 100.7, and that wasn't exactly the stuff of which high melodrama was made. The fever had probably been caused more by his general rundown condition than any specific infection, and an oogie old fever was no problem for Annie. Among her other souvenirs, Annie had Keflex and ampicillin up the old kazoo. She dosed him and he got better as it was possible to get under such bizarre circumstances at any rate. But something was wrong. He seemed to have lost some vital ingredient, and the mix had become a lot less potent as a result. He tried to blame it on the missing N, but he'd had that to contend with before. And really, what was a missing N compared to a missing foot? And now, as an extra added attraction, a missing thumb. Whatever the reason, something had disturbed the dream. Something was whittling away the circumference of that hole in the paper through which he saw. Once he would have sworn it was so. That hole had been as big as the bore of the Lincoln Tunnel. Now it was no more than the size of a knothole, through which a sidewalk superintendent might stoop to snoop on an interesting piece of building construction. You had to peer and crane to see anything at all, and more often than not, the really important things happened outside your field of vision. Not surprising, considering the field of vision was so small. In practical terms, what had happened following the thumbectomy and ensuing bouts of fever was obvious. The language of the book had grown florid and overblown again. It was not self-parody yet, not quite, but it was floating steadily in that direction,
and he seemed helpless to stop it. Continuity lapses had begun to proliferate with the stealth of rats breeding in cellar corners. For a space of 30 pages, the Baron had become the Viscount from Misery's Quest. He'd had to go back and tear that all out. "It doesn't matter, Paul," he told himself again and again. In those last few days, before the Royal coughed up its first T and then its E, the damn thing is almost done. So it was. Working on it was torture, and finishing it was going to mean the end of his life. That the latter had begun to look slightly more attractive than the former said all that probably needed to be said about the worsening state of his body, mind, and spirit. And the book moved on in spite of everything, seemingly independent of them. The continuity drops were annoying but minor. He was having more problems with the actual make-believe than he ever had before. The game of Can You had become a labored exercise rather than simple, good fun. Yet the book had continued to roll, in spite of all the terrible things Annie had subjected him to, and he could bitch about how something, his guts maybe, had run out of him along with a half pint or so of blood he'd lost when she took his thumb. But it was still a goddamn good yarn. The best Misery novel by far. The plot was melodramatic but well constructed, in its own modest way quite amusing. If it were ever published in something other than the severely limited, first printing one copy, Annie Wilkes edition, he guessed it might sell like a mad bastard. Yeah, he supposed he would get through it, if the goddamn typewriter held together. "You were supposed to be so tough," he had thought once, after one of his compulsive lifting exercises. His thin arms were trembling, the stump of his thumb aching feverishly, his forehead covered with a thin oil of sweat. "You were the tough young gunsel looking to make a rep off the tired old turd of a sheriff, right? Only you've already thrown one key, and I see the way some of the others, the T, the E, and the G, for instance, are starting to look funny. Sometimes leaning one way, sometimes leaning the other. Sometimes riding a little high on the line. Sometimes dipping a little low. I think maybe the tired old turd is going to win this one, my friend. I think maybe the tired old turd is going to beat you to death. And it could be that the bitch knew it. Could be that's why she took my left thumb. Like the old saying goes, she may be crazy, but she sure ain't dumb." He had looked at the typewriter with tired intensity. "Go on. Go on and break. I'll finish anyway. If she wants to get me a replacement, I'll thank her kindly. But if she doesn't, I'll finish on my goddamn legal pads. The one thing I won't do is scream. I won't scream. I won't. I won't scream." He sat at the window, totally awake now, totally aware that the police car he was seeing in Annie's driveway was as real as his left foot had once been. Scream! God damn it, scream! He wanted to, but the dictum was too strong, just too strong. He didn't even open his mouth. He tried and saw the brownish droplets of betadine flying from the blade of the electric knife. He tried and heard the squeal of the axe against bone, the soft flump as the match in her hand lit the Burns-O-Matic. He tried to open his mouth and couldn't. Tried to raise his hands, couldn't. A horrible moaning sound passed between his closed lips, and his hands made light, haphazard drumming sounds on either side of the Royal, but that was all he could do, all the control of his destiny he could seem to take. Nothing which had gone before, except perhaps for the moment when he realized that although his left leg was moving, his left foot was staying put, was as terrible as the hell of this immobility. In real time, it did not last long, perhaps 5 seconds, and surely no longer than 10. But inside Paul Sheldon's head, it seemed to go on for years. There, within plain sight, was salvation. All he had to do was break the window and the dog lock the bitch had put on his tongue, and scream, "Help me! Help me! Save me from Annie! Save me from the goddess!" At the same time, another voice was screaming, "I'll be good, Annie. I won't scream. I'll be good. I'll be good for God's sake. I promise not to scream. Just don't chop off any more of me.
Had he known? Before this, had he really known how badly she had cowed him, or how much of his essential self, the liver and lights of his spirit, she had scraped away? He knew how constantly he had been terrorized. But did he know how much of his own subjective reality, once so strong he had taken it for granted, had been erased? He knew one thing with some certainty. A lot more was wrong with him than paralysis of the tongue, just as a lot more was wrong with what he had been writing than the missing key, or the fever, or continuity lapses, or even a loss of guts. The truth of everything was so simple in its horridness, so dreadfully simple. He was dying by inches, but dying that way wasn't as bad as he'd already feared. But he was also fading, and that was an awful thing because it was moronic.
Don't scream!
The panicky voice screamed just the same as the cop opened the door of the cruiser and stepped out, adjusting his smoky bear hat as he did so. He was young, no more than 22 or 23, wearing sunglasses as black and liquid-looking as dollops of crude oil. He paused to adjust the creases of his khaki uniform pants, and 30 yards away, a man with blue eyes bulging from his white and whiskery old man's face sat staring at him from behind a window, moaning through closed lips, hands rattling uselessly on a board laid across the arms of a wheelchair. Don't scream. Yes, scream. Scream and it will be over. Scream and it can end. Never, never going to end. Not until I'm dead. That kid's no match for the goddess. Paul, oh Christ, are you dead already? Scream, you chicken shit motherfucker. Scream your fucking head off. His lips pulled apart with a minute tearing sound. He hitched air into his lungs and closed his eyes. He had no idea what was going to come out or if anything really was, until it came.
Africa!
Paul screamed. Now his trembling hands flew up like startled birds and clapped against the sides of his head, as if to hold in his exploding brains. Africa! Africa, help me! Help me, Africa! His eyes snapped open. The cop was looking toward the house. Paul could not see the smoky's eyes because of the sunglasses, but the tilt of his head expressed moderate puzzlement. He took a step closer, then stopped. Paul looked down at the board. To the left of the typewriter was a heavy ceramic ashtray. Once upon a time, it would have been filled with crushed butts. Now it held nothing more hazardous to his health than paper clips and a typewriter eraser. He seized it and threw it at the window. Glass shattered outward. To Paul, it was the most liberating sound he had ever heard. The walls came tumbling down, he thought giddily, and screamed.
Over here! Help me! Watch out for the woman! She's crazy!
The state cop stared at him. His mouth dropped open. He reached into his breast pocket and brought out something that could only be a picture. He consulted it, and then advanced to the edge of the driveway. There he spoke the only 4 words Paul ever heard him say, the last 4 words anyone ever heard him say. Following them, he would make a number of inarticulate sounds, but no real words.
Oh, shit!
The cop exclaimed.
It's you!
Paul's attention had been so fiercely focused on the trooper that he did see her, he was struck by a real superstitious horror. Annie had become a goddess, a thing that was half woman and half lawn boy, a weird female centaur. Her baseball cap had fallen off. Her face was twisted in a frozen snarl. In one hand she held a wooden cross. It had marked the grave of the bossy. Paul didn't remember if it was number 1 or number 2, which had finally stopped bawling. That bossy had indeed died, and when spring had softened the ground enough, Paul had watched from his window, sometimes dumbstruck with awe and sometimes overcome with shrieking attacks of the giggles, as she first dug the grave
It had taken her most of the day, and then dragged Bossy, who had also softened considerably, out from behind the barn. She had used a chain attached to the Cherokee's trailer hitch to do this. She had looped the other end of the chain around Bossy's middle. Paul made a mental bet with himself that Bossy would tear in half before Annie got her to the grave, but that one he lost. Annie tumbled Bossy in, then stolidly began refilling the hole, a job she hadn't finished until long after dark. Paul had watched her plant the cross and then read the Bible over the grave by the light of the new-risen spring moon. Now she was holding the cross like a spear. The dirt-darkened point of its vertical post pointed squarely at the trooper's back.
"Behind you! Look out!"
Paul shrieked, knowing he was too late, but shouting anyway. With a thin, warbling cry, Annie plunged Bossy's cross into the trooper's back.
"Ugh,"
the cop said, and walked slowly onto the lawn, his pierced back arched and his gut sticking out. His face was the face of a man either trying to pass a kidney stone or having a terrible gas attack. The cross began to droop toward the ground as the trooper approached the window in which Paul sat, his gray invalid's face framed by jags of broken glass. The cop reached slowly over his shoulders with both hands. He looked at Paul like a man trying very hard to scratch that one itch you can never quite reach. Annie had dismounted the lawn boy and had been standing frozen, her tented fingers pressed against the peaks of her breasts. Now she lunged forward and snatched the cross out of the trooper's back. He turned toward her, groping for his service pistol, and Annie drove the cross point first into his belly.
"Ugh!"
the cop said this time, and dropped to his knees, clutching his stomach. As he bent over, Paul could see the slit in his brown uniform shirt where the first blow had gone home. Annie pulled the cross free again. Its sharpened point had broken off, leaving a jagged, splintery stump, and drove it into his back between the shoulder blades. She looked like a woman trying to kill a vampire. The first two blows had perhaps not gone deep enough to do much damage, but this time the cross's support post went at least 3 inches into the kneeling trooper's back, driving him flat.
"There!"
Annie cried, wrenching Bossy's memorial marker out of his back.
"How do you like that, you old dirty bird?"
"Annie, stop it!" Paul shouted. Annie looked up at him, her dark eyes momentarily as shiny as coins, her hair fungus frowsy around her face, the corners of her mouth drawn up in the jolly grin of a lunatic who has, at least for the moment, cast aside all restraints. Then she looked back down at the state trooper.
"There!"
she cried, and drove the cross into his back again, and his buttocks, and the upper thigh of one leg, and his neck, and his crotch, and stabbed him with it a half a dozen times, screaming,
"There!"
every time she brought it down again. Then the cross's upright split.
"There!"
she said, almost conversationally, and walked away in the direction from which she had come running. Just before she passed from Paul's view, she tossed the bloody cross aside as if it no longer in Paul's hands of the chair, not at all sure where he intended to go, or what, if anything, he meant to do when he got there. To the kitchen for a knife, perhaps. Not to try to kill her with. Oh, no. She would take one look at the knife in his hand and step back into the shed for her 30-30. Not to kill her, but to defend himself from her revenge by cutting his wrists open. He didn't know if that had been his intention or not, but it surely did seem like a hell of a good idea, because if there had ever been a time to exeunt stage left, this was it. He was tired of losing pieces of himself to her fury. Then he saw something which froze him in place. The cop. The cop was still alive. He raised his head. His sunglasses had fallen off. Now Paul could see his eyes. Now he could see how young the cop was, how young and hurt and scared. Blood ran down his face in streams. He managed to get to his hands and knees, fell forward, and then got painfully back up again. He began to crawl toward his cruiser. He worked his way halfway down the mild slope of grass between the house and the driveway, then overbalanced and fell on his back. For a moment he lay there with his legs drawn up, looking as helpless as a turtle in its shell.